Next case is Otsuka Pharmaceutical Company v. Sandoz et al. In Apotex and Teva, 2011, 1126 and 1127. We'll hear first from Ms. Holland, and you are for Teva?
Teva. May it please the Court, I'm going to be addressing the issue of double patenting. The fundamental legal error that the District Court committed here was to find that the asserted claims were not invalid for double patenting, really only because there was a finding that they were not invalid under 103. Under this Court's precedent, double patenting and 103 are distinct defenses, separate requirements, and especially in a case like this, need to be analyzed separately.
They are somewhat different because one relates to claims and one includes disclosure. But how do you show obviousness of say, claim B versus a claim A in an earlier patent, except by the concepts that we use of obviousness, motivation to go from one to another?
Well, Your Honor, specifically in a case like this, when we're talking about a chemical structure. This Court's recent precedent has introduced this concept of lead compound into the obviousness analysis, but that really has no applicability to double patenting because the Court's precedent tells us exactly where to start a double patenting analysis.
You're starting with Claim 13, right?
Correct.
Not a question of whether that's lead or not. It's Claim 13. Well, how do you go, how does one make the changes from Claim 13 to the claimed compound?
So the analysis should be, Your Honor, that you look at Claim 13, the unsubstituted butoxy. You look at asserted Claim 12, which is aripiprazole. You identify the differences, and in this case, these compounds are extremely similar structurally.
There are differences. There are substituents on the claimed compound, and there are no substituents on the benzene ring of Claim 13. So what's so obvious with all of these substituents around to go to two chlorine substituents on those positions?
Your Honor, we submit that the Nakagawa Declaration, which the Court found to be prior art, was in the file history of the 416 patent.
But why would one look at the Nakagawa patent? It's in the prosecution history. If you're talking about a motivation to move from Claim 13 to something else, who would think of digging into a declaration? You look at a declaration to see what an applicant gave up in prosecution.
Because, Your Honor, remember we're talking about a hypothetical person of ordinary skill in the art and what they would learn from the prior art. The Nakagawa Declaration, like everything else in the prior art, has its disclosure that the person of ordinary skill in the art could look at and learn from, not for any one particular purpose, but for whatever's disclosed in there. Once you find Nakagawa is prior art like the district court did, the person of ordinary skill is entitled to look at Nakagawa and learn from Nakagawa what effect the 2-chlorine and 3-chlorine substitutions would have on activity. When you look at Nakagawa, it has empirical data. There was testing done by Otsuka on this very issue. How does chlorine affect activity?
Well, it didn't suggest the 2-chlorine compounds. The best compound in Nakagawa, if one looks at it, is an ethoxy compound.
Your Honor,
5 links instead of 7 links.
Your Honor, again, I think we're falling back into the lead compound analysis.
I didn't say anything about a lead compound. I'm just talking about Claim 13.
Yes, this is different because the only thing you're looking to do here is identify the sole difference between aripiprazole and the unsubstituted butoxy, look at that particular difference, and determine whether there's anything in the prior art that would suggest that particular difference. And in this case, the Nakagawa Declaration, regardless of whatever else it teaches, whatever other substitutes...
Do you think anything in the prior art is necessarily obvious without having any reason to move that particular prior art, those substituents?
The Nakagawa Declaration, if you're looking in the context of double patenting and you're looking only at the differences between structures, You're looking to what in the prior art suggests that particular difference. You're not looking at what the prior art suggested 10 other things that were possible that could have been done to the molecule. You're looking only at that particular difference, and the question is, was there something in the prior art that suggested that difference?
I'm not sure I agree with that as a premise, a starting point for the legal analysis. Nakagawa disclosed 4 molecules with better activity than the unsubstituted butoxy. I don't know how to say all these words, so I'm going to butcher them, but I'll try my best. And so one of skill in the arts, if they're even going to look at this Nakagawa declaration, then aren't they going to look at it and use one of these other molecules that's disclosed as the starting point for making modifications?
Well, not in the double patenting context, because we know you have to start with the unsubstituted butoxy. You know, obviousness, that's a separate issue. You may be looking at Nakagawa to see where should I start. But in double patenting, we know where to start. You must start with the unsubstituted butoxy. Then you look at Nakagawa and say, is there anything here that teaches me what to do with the unsubstituted butoxy? And there is. There's a teaching that putting chlorines at the 2 position or the 3 position is going to improve the activity. So,
as Judge Moore said, those aren't the best compounds in Nakagawa. The butoxy compound is the best compound.
For this double patenting analysis, Your Honor, it doesn't really make a difference whether or not it was the best compound.
That's very interesting. So for double patenting, this is a way in which the obvious analysis would be different. You're saying my comment or criticism that Nakagawa discloses 4 other molecules that it says are better starting points is fair for a general obviousness analysis, but not for double patenting because of the claim? Because the claim is to the butoxy, so you would disregard the other 4, even though they had better starting points, because they aren't the unsubstituted butoxy.
Exactly.
And that's why you would focus on that.
Yes. And then the only question is, what do you do with the unsubstituted butoxy? If you have the compound, what does Nakagawa say to do with it? And Nakagawa says, add chlorines at the 2 position and at the 3 position, and not at the 4 position, for example.
You want to split your time with your colleague, and you wanted to save some time, so...
Yes, Your Honor.
We've got a little more than a minute left, so we hear from Ms. Feldman. Good morning.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm going to address the issues of obviousness. One issue the Court just brought up is why you would look at the chlorine-substituted compounds from the Nakagawa Declaration. Your Honor, obviousness is not an either...
Of course, I asked first why one would look at the Nakagawa Declaration if one wanted to improve on antipsychotics. Why wouldn't one start with the best antipsychotics of the time, clozapine and risperidone?
Your Honor, you could, and those could be obvious too, but
yeah,
there's not a single obvious
compound. There
weren't
any carbosteryl compounds that were outstanding or marketed, were there?
Not that were marketed, but there were some that were noted in the prior art, Your Honor, by Otsuka itself. In other words, Otsuka itself was touting a whole class of carbosteryl compounds.
It disclosed between 200 and 300 compounds and had a laundry list of benefits that these compounds might be advantageously used for, the primary of which is as an antihistamine. It does mention schizophrenia, but it doesn't link schizophrenia up with any particular disclosed compounds.
Your Honor, I assume you're talking about the 416 patent?
Yeah, isn't that what you were just going to talk about?
I can't talk about that, but I'm also talking about OPC 4392, OPC 4139.
All right, I'm sorry, I thought that you were going on.
I will go to 416, Your Honor, but the point is that Otsuka was publishing on several carbosteryl compounds, and it wasn't saying these things are terrible or don't look at them. It's saying, particularly with respect to OPC 4392, that this has promising anti-schizophrenic activity. Look at it. It's doing things that other conventional anti-schizophrenic compounds can't do.
Well, 4392 was also listed as an antihistaminic, and it had, I count, 4 points of difference between 4392 and aripiprazole. That's a lot of territory to traverse to get to obviousness.
Well, unfortunately for us, we actually have positive findings on those particular points from the district court judge. One of the changes is to homologate, basically to grow the linker, extend the linker. The judge gave us that finding that a person of ordinary skill in the art would be expected to do homologation. the district. The other, one other difference is the single and the double bond on the carbostyral core. The district court also found the first Murray skill in the art would be motivated to make that change. And in fact, according to the FDA label, aripiprazole as the dehydro is in fact active and responsible for some of its activity. So those are both taken care of. And now what you're talking about...
Well, when you say taken care of, what is it that you really mean by that? You're on appeal.
Yeah, well, the person where he's still in the art, which the court found is that they're motivated to make those changes.
But that's on appeal. So it's not taken care of. It's not like it's off the table for our consideration.
Well, I understand that.
You've got four changes from one of these molecules to the other. It makes it radically different. The idea that the district court said any one of those changes... one of skill in the art might have been motivated to make individually if it was only a single change is one thing. But when you're looking at a difference between four, you know, with four differences, and the idea is somebody has to be motivated to make all of them and all at the same time, not one at a time.
Correct.
So I see some problems with that finding.
We believe that the...
And your statement that it's all taken care of.
I'll withdraw the all taken care of statement. But in reality, we believe that the art, if you look at the art as a whole, not in single individual aspects, if you look at the prior...
But you have a single claim, a very specific claim with very definite substituents. You're not claiming a general group, at least with this claim.
At least with this claim, that's true. But, you know, recall that the genus is disclosed. This is a genus species situation. And the genus patent was described and was listed in the Orange Book as covering aripiprazole.
Is it a genus claim before us, or is it a species claim before us?
It's a particular species claim. But the prior art as a whole, you have to look at the close structural analogs, homologs. Henry Dillon says that. Henry Grabiak says that. A lot of the precedent says that. Okay, and then what needs to be shown is that aripiprazole is better, okay, it's quoting from 103, that it's better than the closest prior art. In our view, it's not unexpectedly better than the closest prior art. In our view, the changes you would have to make, particularly growing the linker length, if you rely on the SAR data that's actually out there, would suggest that you want to grow the linker length, and your expectation is that you're going to have anti-schizophrenic behavior. And going back to the 416 patent, you know, it says that these types of compounds, although it's claimed broadly, obviously, in a broad genus, that these types of compounds have this type of activity. And it doesn't say it only has antihistaminic activity, or that if something has antihistaminic activity, it's not going to have other activity. These things are not mutually exclusive.
But wouldn't that teach away, if it's antihistaminic, wouldn't that teach away from trying to develop into the field of a psychotropic, treating these psychotropic effects?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. There's record evidence showing that antischizophrenics and antihistaminics were known at the time to have similar types of activities, and that many antipsychotics had antihistamine.
But the difference is that whether one also affected the negative results as opposed to the positive results.
Well, that's a different issue. I was OPC-4392 treated the negative symptoms of schizophrenia. It also had some activity in the positive symptoms. But with respect to the antihistaminics versus the antischizophrenics, there was general literature disclosures. In fact, there were admissions by Otsuka in an interference proceeding that known antischizophrenics would also be expected to have antihistaminic behavior and vice versa. And interference had to do with the 416 patent. So just because something is an antihistamine doesn't mean it's not going to be antischizophrenic. And the fact is you have a broad disclosure that Otsuka should be stuck with, okay, that these types of compounds having this type of structure are going to have antischizophrenic activity and antihistaminic activity. And
all of them?
They could, absolutely.
Well, they could, but they could. There's 200 to 300 of them, and there's a whole list of possible benefits that might be achieved from using them.
Absolutely. The consequence of claiming a genus broadly, okay, is that you're stuck with that disclosure. In other words, no one could ever be surprised that a compound that has this particular structure is going to have this type of activity, be it anti-schizophrenic, anti-histaminic. And in fact, what we see from aripiprazole even, and the court relied on this as a supposed unexpected result, is that it had multiple types of activity. Well, in fact, the 416 patent says that compounds of this type should have multiple types of activity, anti-schizophrenic, antidepressant, other types of things. And the other thing that the 416 patent said is that it would have low incidence of side effects. Well, aripiprazole had low incidence of side effects. And I see that my time is running out.
All right, you have exhausted it, but we'll give you a minute that you lost for back.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Monroe.
Thank you. May it please the Court, after almost a month of trial, the District Court made very detailed fact findings in which the Court made credibility determinations regarding expert testimony of the witnesses, and the appellants have failed to establish any basis to find those fact findings clearly erroneous or that the Court committed any legal error. With respect to some of the specific issues that were just raised, Otsuka has contended all along that one has to actually find, consistent with this Court's precedent in Daiichi, Takeda, Isai, one has to find some basis why one of ordinary skill in the art would have been led to a particular compound and start there as part of an antipsychotic drug discovery effort, and then you have to point something in the prior art that would teach one to modify the compound in a specific way to get the desired result. Here, what the District Court ultimately said at one point is appellants have tried to just pluck things from the art and say this looks like a picture of something that would be like a
paper. For general obviousness, I understand your argument, but Ms. Holland has made a good point. I, quite frankly, didn't come across as clearly in the briefing, but I'm sort of latching onto it now in my mind, and I'd like to hear you respond to it. In the context of obviousness-type double patenting, when you're starting necessarily with the unsubstituted butoxy, that's the molecule you're starting with. And if the Nakagawa Declaration is one of the things in the prior art, even though it discloses five things, it's not one of the situations where you're just cherry-picking, right? You only can look at the unsubstituted butoxy as the starting point. Maybe it is or isn't obvious in light of that, but what do you think of that argument at first?
Your Honor, I think there are two separate issues. One is, what do you start with? We agree that in a double patenting analysis, one starts with the claim. What is in that claim?
And that's the claim to butoxy. Right.
But then you have to look at what analysis do you conduct once you have that compound? And I would harken back even to Judge Richard's concurrence in the Zickenstrock case from a long time ago, where he said the analysis of this is the same because the principle is the same. If you look at what an ordinary skill in the art would do looking at that compound, would they think of that compound as an antipsychotic, and what would they do to try to modify it to become an antipsychotic? That's where the appellant's argument falls apart. Even their argument for obviousness type double patenting, Teva's argument, focuses on motivation. They try to veil it as to it's a little bit different and it looks the same, but even though it's a little bit different. But really, it's a motivation. Why would one look at that compound, think of it as an antipsychotic, and then why would you go about modifying it in a specific way? And we did argue in the district court and agree with at least the question that was posed, is why would one look to
this
declaration?
The court found, and you don't seem to be appealing this fact-finding, that the Nakagawa Declaration and its comments about mouse jumping equated to schizophrenia, to basically equated to antipsychotic. So you did not appeal that in the briefs. I don't see any appeal of that fact finding. So we've got the Nakagawa Declaration, which lists an unsubstituted butoxy molecule, only one out of the five, and actually links it exactly to antipsychotic testing showing good activity. Wow, that's really close.
Your Honor, I think that's the argument that appellants have made, but we believe that overstates what the court did. What the court said was that the test in the Nakagawa Declaration, the mouse jumping test, is something that one skilled in the art might look to as potential antipsychotic activity. In their briefs, Teva says it's excellent antipsychotic activity. Nowhere did the court find that the Nakagawa Declaration established excellent antipsychotic activity.
Where is that district court finding? Do you happen to know? Because I remember it not being so equivocal the way you just said it. I might be wrong.
Well, there are two parts of the opinion. One part of the opinion, she said that the Nakagawa Declaration said it could show a potential for that activity, could be used to show potential for that activity. Later, the court concluded that if you take that premise, it showed middling potency. She put it in between all of the other compounds that were there. Four were much more potent. And going to the Daiichi case, if you're looking at motivation, the promise of potency outweighs mere structural similarity. And if you look at the declaration, you would be looking to modify the unsubstituted butoxy compound and turn it into a 2-methoxy-propoxy-linked 5-linker compound. That's what you would learn from the Nakagawa Declaration, even if you accepted that it would be something one would look to modify the unsubstituted butoxy compound.
Well, I understand that's your argument about what one would learn from it, but really what I was more curious about was the fact findings of the district court, which I thought pretty clearly linked the unsubstituted butoxy to...
The district court did find the unsubstituted butoxy showed middling potency in the Nakagawa declaration.
5.5. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the best was 0.5.
Yes, the 2-ethoxy, 5-link propoxy compound was a 10 times more potent. And that's why the court found middling potency for the unsubstituted butoxy. And TEP hasn't identified any reason or any motivation why one skilled in the art would go a certain path or a certain route to change that in a specific way in order to get enhanced antipsychotic activity.
Well, Ms. Holland argues that the Nakagawa Declaration suggests using the CL chloride, chlorine,
yes,
whatever those CLs are.
Teva repeatedly talks about suggestion because they know they can't find really anything that would teach one skilled in the art. This additive theory is that one would just look at the Nakagawa Declaration, see there was a 2-chloro and there was a 3-chloro, and automatically go, voila, it should be a 2-3-chloro. The district court specifically rejected Teva's argument in that regard and found it conclusory and inconsistent with the testimony regarding unpredictability that Otsuka's experts provided.
And my clerk just pointed out on 3805, Nakagawa characterizes the activity of all the tested compounds as, quote, excellent. So the fact that it was 5.5 and there might have been a better one, this one was still referred to as excellent in terms of its activity.
In the context of that declaration, that is correct. In the context of that declaration, the Nakagawa Declaration was saying that that class of compounds, compared to the prior art compounds that they were testing, was excellent, showed excellent activity in the mouse jumping test. It doesn't say, and take that next step, that this is to show excellent activity.
I know you don't have a lot of time, but why does mouse jumping correlate to schizophrenia? If you can do it in one or two sentences, if not, I'll research it on the internet.
Actually, the court found that. The court found that the mouse jumping test actually doesn't really correlate to anti-schizophrenic activity. The court did hold against Otsuka the comments that you just noted during in the Nakagawa Declaration and during prosecution of another patent. But the district court ultimately found that the real test for antipsychotic activity in schizophrenia is the anti-apomorphine stereotopy test. And the court specifically found that you can't correlate those two. In fact, the court found if you look at unsubstituted butoxy in the anti-apomorphine stereotopy test, it's inactive. So notwithstanding what it says,
do you think the Nakagawa Declaration is fair game for someone someone skilled in the art who was motivated to try to improve on certain compounds?
No, Your Honor. And that's because our position is that one skilled in the art would need to be directed to that in some way, be looking for that declaration. It was a 1,500-page prosecution history, and I admit I'm a little biased because it goes back to 1988, and the concept that one skilled in the art was able to find the prosecution history in 1988 and then know to go find in that prosecution history the Nakagawa Declaration.
You mean because they were in giant shoes in the patent office?
If they were there, especially after the patent issued. There's now a presumption because everything's on the internet and you get things quickly. We don't believe that one skilled in the art would have been motivated to go find that.
You haven't really challenged it on appeal, have you? Have you challenged the prior art status of Nakagawa, like in a traditional printed publication sense? It wasn't cataloged in a meaningful way. It wasn't available to the public.
We challenged that below, Your Honor, and then on appeal we noted in our footnote our disagreement with the court's finding.
Is its status as prior art really the issue?
No, Your Honor. It's what is it
the issue?
Is the motivation
one would be motivated to look there.
That's correct, Your Honor. If we're looking at the motivation element, it's not whether it is prior art, but why would one go there and find it? Even their experts who testify.
Probably a little easier than going to Sweden and finding the thesis.
That's probably true, Your Honor. But the fact of the case and the findings were that the experts of the defendants noted that they had never, they're the experts saying, opining on motivation, and they didn't even know how to find a prosecution.
Does the declaration teach away in any way?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It teaches the most potent compound, and again, going back to the test in Daiichi, which is you have to look at what looks like promising potency, not structural similarity alone, was the 5-linker 2-ethoxy compound. in that, and the next most potent compound was also a five-linker compound, carboxy compound. So the Gower Declaration actually teaches you an entirely different direction. And that's part of the issue in this case, is the art taught 100 different directions, and the defendants have not established, by clear and convincing evidence, that one skill in the art would have been directed a certain route, a certain path, as discussed in
Should it matter to us the amount of compounds that were listed under the heading of antihistamine in the Nagasaki Declaration? Nakagawa Declaration.
I think the Nakagawa Declaration needs to be taken in context. It was trying to establish superior properties of the prior art. Two of the tests were antihistamines, and one of the tests was this mouse jumping test. And one has to look at it in context. If you look, the unsubstituted butoxy was in the mouse jumping test. But if you look at the 416 patent itself, what it ultimately claimed after the Nakagawa Declaration, it claimed the unsubstituted butoxy as an antihistamine, not as a CNS controlling agent.
Now, this is very crowded out. All these substituents were known. And I also note that 4392 is ascertained to be a safe compound and to have some advantageous effects. So why wasn't 4392 a potential lead compound?
Well, Your Honor, if you go to the point at the time of the critical date, February 31st, 1988, by that time, the literature had shown that yes, maybe it was safe in the sense of it was toxic, didn't kill people. It had serious side effects, had serious problems. And one skill, the Otsuka's experts, which the court credited, testified that one would look at that and read those disclosures as discouraging one towards carbosteryl. And in fact, that's what the history has shown. I mean, it's worth noting that right now there are only 10 atypical antipsychotics approved, and they fall in three classes. One is clozapine and its progeny. One is risperidone and its progeny. And the last class is aripiprazole. There is no other carbosteryl compound that's an approved antipsychotic.
And aripiprazole was the first of that class?
It's the first and only of its class. And after 24 years, no one else has been able to come up with another carbosteryl compound.
So you're saying, what should have been the lead compound?
The lead compound, as shown by history, were clozapine, which begat so many derivatives, risperidone, which begat so many derivatives. Even Apotex admits in its reply brief, no one else in 1988 was looking at carbosteryls.
And what did the court find with respect to what was the lead compound?
The court didn't actually find the lead compound. The court rejected each of the defendant's appellant's proposed lead compounds and then noted that, if anything, one would have also been looking at clozapine or risperidone lead compounds.
I was just saying they looked backwards until they found something that was in the ballpark and called that a lead compound?
Correct. That's what's in our brief. That we think this is the classic hindsight analysis where they just tried to go find something structurally similar among 9 trillion compounds in 416 patent, among hundreds of examples in the other references, and have tried to say those would be lead compounds.
Would your argument be a lead compound is either clozapine or risperidone? Would that be the lead compound then in your...
Our argument would, though, that would, at that point in time in 1988, where carbosteryl 4392 had been shown not to have antipsychotic activity and also have bad side effects, one would not have looked at carbosteryls. They would have looked at clozapine or risperidone.
And started tweaking stuff on those.
Which is what everyone did. That's actually been proven through time. If one accepts, well, maybe they disregarded the failure of 4392 and one looked at carbosteryls and one looked at Nakagawa, it's clear that one would go to the 5-linker carboxy compound shown in Nakagawa, or if you go to the 932 patent, which it had 6-linker compounds with alkyl groups. The art was teaching in different directions for carbosteryl.
Can you address real quickly the application of the Geneva Farms case here in this case with respect to double patenting?
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is that appellants are taking advantage of dicta and a footnote in that case where the court's precedents were clear that these two analyses are the same and that in Geneva, it was an anticipation case when it came down to it. District courts which have reviewed that case, the Federal Circuit is the final rule, but district courts have applied it, have all looked at it and considered it to be an anticipation case. Moreover, if you look at the court's precedent prior to Geneva, there were instances in double patenting where the court looked at motivation. The court looked at secondary considerations such as unexpected results. So those, that's, to the extent Teva argues, Geneva rules, prior precedent rules over Geneva.
Along the lines, if my colleagues would indulge me, because I know your time is up, so one final question for me at least would be, going back to the question I asked you earlier, while the test might be the same, when you're looking at obviousness type double patenting, Ms. Holland's argument seems persuasive that you at least are, since you're starting with the claim molecule, which is unsubstituted butoxy, you then are going to look from there at the prior art, from that vantage point, from the unsubstituted butoxy vantage point, which is quite distinct from just the general obviousness inquiry where you're not starting with unsubstituted butoxy, it could be anything. Do you agree with that logical starting point?
We agree with that, Your Honor, that a double patenting analysis requires one to start with what's claimed. But then you have to ask the question, to do what? What are you going to do with it? You have to have a thing you're deciding you're going to do with this compound, a goal. Why would you have a goal of antipsychotic activity for a compound which has been disclosed to be an antihistamine?
Thank you, Mr. Monroe. Ms. Holland, we'll give you 2 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. To address very quickly Judge Reina's question concerning Geneva, Mr. Monroe said that was an anticipation case. It's unclear from that case whether it was anticipation or obviousness, but regardless, a later Federal Circuit decision, Procter & Gamble versus Teva, was clearly an obviousness-type double patenting case and adopted that same holding about the distinctions between double patenting and obviousness.
But didn't Longhi precede those cases? And Longhi says it's the same analysis. We have to go with the earliest, for the first decision of the Federal Circuit.
There are different formulations in many different Federal Circuit cases. I believe there's an In Re Leolithin case that says that it's similar to, but not exactly the same as obviousness, the double patenting inquiry. So there were several different formulations, but none of them said it was exactly the same inquiry.
Longhi says that, quote, a double patenting of the obviousness type rejection is analogous to a failure to meet the non-obviousness requirements under 3, except that the patent principally underlying the double patenting rejection is not considered prior art.
Yes, analogous, Your Honor, which, again, I would say is not the same. I would also add that there was later case law development on motivation on lead compound that maybe wasn't in existence at the time of Longhi. As the case law developed, the case on that issue developed, the case law on the differences developed as well, and there is a clear statement in the Federal Circuit that motivation, secondary considerations, etc., aren't part of that double patenting analysis. Getting to the point about Nakagawa and prior art, I submit that once you find Nakagawa is prior art,
Why should we find it to be prior art? Was it actually a printed document that was accessible to the public?
Yes, Your Honor. It's clear case law that the file history of a issued patent...
Apart from the file history, was there any other place that this declaration could have been accessed?
No, Your Honor. It was part of the file history, but the law is, and it's been set forth in Federal Circuit cases like Takeda versus Alpha Farm, Breckelmeyer. Once a patent issues its file history, becomes public on the day the patent issues.
Well, that's patent office practice for decades and decades.
Yes,
and decades.
It should not be in dispute here. It is public.
That means it's open to the public and potentially prior art, but that doesn't say anything about whether one would be motivated to go in there.
Your Honor, once it's prior art, the person of ordinary skill is presumed to know its contents. We're talking about hypothetical person of ordinary skill. It's not like they have it on their shelf in their office. They're presumed to know the contents of the prior art. Once Nakagawa is prior art, it is fair game for all its teachings. You don't need a motivation to go there. A particular person of ordinary skill in the art is presumed to know its teachings.
You have one final thought?
Yes, Your Honor. One thing that Mr. Monroe said was that all we can say is that Nakagawa suggests the addition of chlorines, but under KSR, we don't need more than that. The prior art doesn't have to say use chlorines in this particular situation.
Nakagawa's empirical data shows that if you put chlorines in those two positions, you're going to improve activity. That's all a person of ordinary skill in the art needs to know to make that substitution. In the double patenting context, it's just comparing Arapaima's result to the unsubstituted butoxy, and that's the exact substitution, that's the exact difference.
Thank you, Ms. Holland. Ms. Feldman has a minute left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll do my best in a minute. One thing that came up in Mr. Monroe's argument is with respect to why no one else was doing carboxyl derivatives. Well, that's the direct impact of the 416 patent and the genus patent, is it blocked everyone else from playing in the carboxyl space. Hatsuka was the only party that could play in the carboxyl space.
You can make compounds for experimental purposes and go seek a license if they find a better one.
Sure, but no one, why would you do that? They own the space. You can't commercialize it. There was evidence in the record that
other... All you have to do is publish it in a medical journal that's better than anything on the market, and who's going to deny you a license?
Well, there was evidence in the record that no one was going to be motivated to do that. Another point that I want to make is that you don't have to do a lead compound analysis under our obviousness theory, particularly with respect to the propoxy dichloro, because it's the closest homolog. And so the standard is there anything unexpectedly better about aripiprazole compared to the propoxy dichloro? We believe there's evidence that there wasn't. We believe that the data, the actual empirical data from the Nakagawa declaration between a propoxy versus a butoxy shows that you're going to expect that a butoxy compound is going to have more potency, and that's the only difference between the propoxy dichloro and the butoxy dichloro, which is aripiprazole.
One final thought?
Yeah. One final thought is this, okay? By making it too easy to get patents on these particular compounds, I understand there's benefits that's given by these particular compounds and that they're helping people, but you're not actually enhancing innovation at all. What you're really doing by making it too easy, by allowing people to just make minor changes and variations, and remember, this only took 3 months for them to go from OPC 4392 to aripiprazole, and that's only because they mislabeled the bottle. Okay, once they realized there was activity at the 2 and the 3 position, it took them like a couple of days to get to this compound.
How long did they spend in clinical trial and in clearance to the FDA?
They spent, obviously, a lot of time on OPC 4392.
Maybe 10 years.
But that's in the prior art. That counts against them for this purpose. They don't get the second benefit. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, so we take a number of cards.
Thank you, Your Honor.